fancy makeup on Wednesday night.
Yeah, there's a mala.
Yes. Okay, I didn't hear the whole schedule.
Okay, so we have two agendas for today. We have two agendas for today. Is there an extra one? Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to need one on the map. Agenda number one is loose ends, to fill in, complete, kind of. And agenda number two, if we finish agenda number one, is to start next perek. So we're going to start from the end of perek Yud Dalet, Pasuk Mem Vav, 1446.
Yud Dalet, page 342.
The last couple of weeks we've been discussing the battle between the forces of Shaul and the Plishtim at Michmas. That battle ends in Pasuk Mem Vav. Vaya'al Shaul me'acharei Plishtim, u'Plishtim halchulim komam. First, we talked about in Lahashir, Shaul and his army went back to their arena or their region. The Plishtim went back to their place or to their home. In other words, this great battle that had all the potential for being the final blow for the Plishtim, because of whatever happened in chapter 14 to derail the follow-up and the battle against the Plishtim, the end result was a stalemate. So the Plishtim went back. Now, a success in the sense that the Plishtim, instead of being in the heart of the country in the area of Michmas, Har Betel, etc., the north of Yerushalayim, the Plishtim went back limkomam to their region, Eretz Plishtim, Gaza, Aza, Gat, Ashkelon, their territory where they live, the coast south.
They retreated.
They went back to their, right, their incursion into the land was unsuccessful. They retreated back to their area. Shaul went back to their area. But what Shaul had hoped to accomplish, which was to destroy the Plishtim once and for all, atal lo vaftam akab, pasuk lamed vav, vayomer shul nerda acharei Plishtim laila v'navozu v'hem ator aboker v'lo nasher behem ish. At the intent, the hope, which was to chase the Plishtim to the point where, at least militarily, perhaps even more dramatically, the Plishtim would cease to be a threat for Israel forever, that was unachieved, and the end result was a stalemate. And that's how the story ends. The remaining verses of chapter 14 are a complete new subject. So even though it kind of looks like it continues here from 46 to 47, Memvav to Memzayin, a kind of just one paragraph, the reality is, if we read these psukim, you'll see that this is now a new subject. So I'm picking up from Pasuk Memzayin. V'Shaul lachad hamelucha al Yisrael. Shaul solidified, gathered, expanded the kingdom of Israel. Ve'ilachem saviv b'cholevav, successfully navigated the battles against all of their enemies surrounding them. B'moav, b'vnei Amon, ve'edom, u'v'malchei Tzova, u'v'aplishtim, u'v'chol asher yifneh yershia. Shaul waged war against all their enemies successfully, against Moab, Ammon, Edom, the kings of Tzova, the Plishtim, and wherever he turned, he was successful. Yershia is an interesting word. It's the same word as the word Yoshia, meaning he was successful, he was victorious. There's some discussion as to what the root of the word is, because it's an odd word. It appears only twice in Tanakh. It seems to come from the word Rasha, or yeah. Resha, It's not really. It translates. Meaning he is able to succeed against those who he's fighting, so he causes them to fall or falter, which is one way of looking at it. But it's essentially another way, or a more fanciful way of saying that he was successful against his enemies. Vaya'as chayil, strong warrior. Vayachat amalek, smote amalek. Vayatzel et Yisrael miyad shaseu. And he was able to save Israel from the hands of those who would plunder them or attack them. Vayu b'nei Shaul, Yonatan v'yishviu Malkishua. The names of his sons, Shaul's sons, Yonatan, Yishvi, and Malkishua. Shem Shtevunotav, Shem Abachira Merav, Shem Akatana Michal. Two daughters, the older one Merav, the younger one Michal. Shem Eshet Shaul, Achinoam ben Achimatz, his wife, Achinoam ben Achimatz. Shem Sar Tzavo, after all of these battles that is described here, we need to know who navigated those battles successfully. His general's name was Aviner, or Avner, ben Ner, Dod Shaul. Avner ben Ner, meaning Avner, son of Ner, Shaul's uncle. Ner is Shaul's uncle. Avner is Shaul's cousin. V'kish, Avi Shaul, V'ner, Avi Avner, ben or b'nei Aviel. Kish, Shaul's father, and Ner, Avner's father, were the sons of Aviel. And that is the, well, one more pasuk. Fatihim b'chamach hazakah l'plishtim koyemei Shaul. Shaul's ongoing battle was always with the plishtim from day one until the end of his life. Remember, he falls. Shaul falls in battle. The end of his life is the last battle he campaigns is against the plishtim in Har Gilboa, where he dies, but that also against the plishtim. So from his very first battle to his very last, Shaul is engaged with a constant struggle with the plishtim. V'ra'a Shaul kol ish gibor chayil v'chol ben chayil v'yasveu elav. He spent his career gathering together the giborei chayil of his people to put together an army that was strong and able to protect the people of Israel. That is the end of Perek Yudalet. I want to describe to me the basic message, tenor, conclusion of these psukim. What is the purpose of this section of this parak?
Well, it's usually where you'd start about who his family was, who he came from.
Right, so Shaul's case, it's interesting. Later we'll see, certainly in the case of other kings, the description of family is usually first, wife and children. In Shaul's case, it's at the end, but it certainly has that description of the family, the royal family, if you will, and who the royal family is. What else?
He was a conqueror.
Right? There's a description of all the battles and all the wars that he fought. We have a picture of Shaul that is generated by three or four major stories. This battle against Bnei Amon and Jevesh Gilad, the first battle. The battle against the Plishtim in Michmas, chapters 13 and 14. The battle against Amalek, which is chapter 15. And if you look at Shaul just from the perspective of the three stories that we have an elaboration of, Yavesh Gilad, the two coronation ceremonies, which are episodes in between, but Yavesh Gilad, Michmas, and Amalek, you get a very somewhat skewed picture of who and what Shaul was. We tend to judge Shaul on the basis of those stories. And certainly from the Battle of Michmas, chapters 13, 14, Battle of Amalek, chapter 15, and then David comes along the scene, and then the rest of the story is David and Shaul's civil war. But David is the centerpiece of that story. So we tend to judge Shaul on the basis of the stories that we have before us and the conflict that he has with Shmuel and the number of times that he trips over the suggested instructions. And so if you look at Shaul and judge Shaul just on the basis of the four stories that we've learned, like the coronation and his failure in the coronation, the battle of Yavesh Gilad, which is before he becomes the king, the Chara, it seems. The two chapters of the story of Michmas and his failures, both with Yonatan and with Shmuel, and then the Battle of Amalek, you get the sense that Shmuel's story is very contained, very short-lived. Shaul's story is very contained, very short-lived, and full of failures. What we miss are these verses here. And what these verses present to us is a much more elaborate picture of the life and the times of Shaul HaMelech. And that's not uncommon in Tanakh, where the basic summary of all of the events of the king are not recorded. We have no record of his battle with Moab. We have a record of the battle of Moab with Ammon in that one skirmish with Yavesh Gilad, but we don't have an ongoing description of his battles against Moab, Ammon. We don't have a description of his battles against Edom. We don't have a description of his battles against Malchei Tzova. What are Malchei Tzova? Malchei Tzova is an enormously important phrase here. Tzova is, in modern terms, is Aleppo. Okay, the famous Aleppo Codex is called the Keter Aram Tzova.
Right.
Okay. So if we're talking about a battle against the kings of Tzova, the kings of Aleppo, we're talking about a battle against the kings of Mesopotamia.
Wow.
What will later become the kingdoms of Assyria, Babel, etc. That's a whole different region of the country, northeast, bordering on the Euphrates River. We'll talk about that in a moment. So those are major battles. Those aren't small skirmishes.
Something's never changed.
but that's not the issue. The issue we have to. I find it very important always to separate modern times from Tanakh in the sense of the political structure today is dramatically different than it was in the time of Tanakh. We have to be careful about drawing conclusions. But just to kind of get a frame of reference, right, we're talking about a regional sweep of the area. We tend to look at Shaul in the focus of the internal dynamic Shaul Plishtim, or Shaul Shmuel, or Shaul David. We often miss the extent to which Shaul was a warrior, had spent his career as king, gathering an army and a fighting force together. Remember, that was what was the primary mandate of Malach Yisrael? The primary mandate was to gather and to create an army. And that's the last pasuk that he spent his whole life gathering together. Gathering together an army. He starts with an army of Yavesh Gilad with 300,000 soldiers. His last major campaign that we will learn about is Amalek, with 200,000 soldiers. It's a couple of battles in between with smaller armies, but he spent his life gathering together a major, not as large as the army of David HaMelech, which was at its height probably 1.3 or 1.4 million. But it was significant for its time.
Was he not following the mandate?
He was following the mandate.
So then that's perfectly okay.
I'm not suggesting this as a critique. I'm suggesting this as a balance to all of the criticism. In other words, the stories that the Navi elaborates on are the stories of Shaul's missteps, if you will. But that doesn't take away from him all of the successes that we need to attribute and recognize, and he had many of them. His ability to fight the battles of Israel, to defend the borders of Israel against those who would try to attack Ammon, Moab, Tzova, Plishtim. Right? There is a larger scale picture here of the Middle East, and in that case, in that context, nothing changes. Right? There's a larger context here of the Middle East in which Israel is constantly under siege and needs to protect itself. And so even if his battle with the Plishtim ended in a stalemate, and we'll continue in this battle with Amalek ends in a stalemate, and with other examples, But the overall experience and context here is one of Sha'ul a warrior. And Sha'ul is able to battle and to defend the boundaries of Israel. I'll go one step further. If you take a look at you don't have those psukim on the sheets. You'll have to look at them in text. Take a look in Divra Hayamim, also known as Chronicles. Oh, no, you do have it here. Sorry. Oh, I put them on the page. Sources, I just skipped them. Sources 2 and 3. If you want it in English, you can look them up, but the Hebrew is here. This is references in the book of Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim is a book that goes through all of history all over again, but there's a lot of information that's in Divrei Hayamim that's not in the rest of Tanakh, kind of supplemental information back and forth. And there it states, V'lemizrach Yeshav, that we sat, we dwelt, we lived in the east. Remember, there were tribes that lived on the east side of the Yarden. So it's describing the territory of Reuven, Gad. Ad levom edabara lemin ahar neprat, ki miknehem rabu be'eretz Gilad. The tribes of Reuven, Gad, half of Menashe, that lived on the east side of the Yarden from the days of Moshe, because they were grazing, they had a lot of cattle. Ubi mei Sha'ul asu milchama im ha-hagri'im, ויפלו בידם וישו באוהליהם על כל פני מזרח לגלעד. In the days of Sha'ul, they had waged war against the Hagri'im. Who are the Hagri'im? I'll explain in a moment. And were successful and dwelt in their tents or in their area all the way through the area east of the Gilad. In a later verse of the same parak, which is source 3, Reuven Gad, half of Menashe, it describes in Pasuk Yutet, V'yasu milchama ima hagriim, vitur v'nafish v'nodav. Again, groups of people, we don't necessarily know who they are yet, but new territory, new nations. So in addition to Ammon, Moab, Plisht Edom, Malchei Tzova, Plishtim, and Amalek, now we have four additional names of regions or nations in that area: Hagriim, Vitur, Nafish, and Nodav. Ve'yazlu aleihem, ve'yinatnu bnei yadam ha'agriim v'chol she'imahem. God gave over into their hands the Hagriim and all who were with them, these other nations. Why? Ki lelokim za'aku b'melchama v'nato lehem ki batchuvo. They called out to God in their wars, and God answered them, because they trusted in him. In other words, the statement in Divrei Hayamim is, why are they successful in all of these battles?
They turned Hashem.
Because they were loyal to Hashem. And this comes back to something we've talked about a number of times, that very often in Tanakh, we get a skewed picture. Because Tanakh highlights the mistakes. It highlights the negative. It highlights the moments of failure in great detail. Whereas when we were successful, you get one-sentence summaries. They trusted God. They were successful against Ammon, Moab, Bnei Ammon, Plishtim, Aram Tzova, and Malkei Tzova, and all of the kings in the east. They were successful. I have four psukim to describe how successful they were over the course of Shaul's life and career. Where I have five or six chapters before David to describe his failures. So it gives us a very skewed picture, because we spend so much time talking about the failure of Sha'ul, but it's not fair to judge Sha'ul just on the basis of those failures. It's important to put into perspective the broader picture of Sha'ul's campaigns and military success. He was, after all, the king of Israel. That was his primary mandate. And to a large extent, he was successful in that regard. So it's an important perspective to have. It's very common in Tanakh to kind of summarize the good in very short terms, and then to spend more time discussing the mistakes so we can learn from them. That's positive reinforcement was not part of the language of the Nevi'im at the time. Yeah?
That's exactly what I was going to ask you, is why would you guess
we spend so much time on that.
Because that's the way they wrote in those days. It's actually a mirror image, if you want, to, if you think about it. It's a mirror image of the chronicles of all the ancient kingdoms. If you read the chronicles and the hieroglyphics or the tablets of all the ancient kings of every nation around, you'll find a very interesting phenomenon. They fought lots of wars. They were victorious in all of their battles.
And they never lost about their victory.
And they never lost a war. So Egypt never lost a battle. Syria never lost a battle. Now if Syria fought Egypt, that battle appears in the Chronicles of Syria if they won, and it appears in the Chronicles of Egypt if they won. If they lost, it won't be there. In other words, nations chronicled their successful campaigns. That's what nations did. That's how kings wrote their stories. That was common in the ancient world.
So that's why we're different.
Tanakh is written not only from a different perspective, but almost a mirror image perspective, in that our successes are...
Hashem's success.
Well, they're successes, but they're...
They're minimized.
They're one sentence. The land was... What we learned Sefer Shoftim, we saw this often, right? If they were successful, if the people were loyal to God, if the land was quiet, if there was no wars, if everything was good, the land was quiet for 40 years. Next story.
That was big. Land was quiet.
Right? The land was quiet for 40 years. Next story. And what happened in those 40 years? Wonderful things. Great technological successes. Startup nation. I don't know what happened to those. Right? But that's all it tells us. Whereas you get to the story of Gideon and the war with Midian, and then you're going to have three Prakim. You get to the story of Barak, and you're going to have two stories, or two chapters. Because those were the times when we tripped spiritually, and we needed to get back to the land was quiet for 40 years, if we ever got back. So that's part of the style of Tanakh. It's just a fact. It's one of the reasons why Tanakh reads as kind of a depressing book, because on the one hand, it's a record of all of our failed moments.
That is depressing.
That is depressing. But there are...
Guilty all the time.
That's right. That's why. But there are, A, to learn from those failures, and B, there are moments that we have to highlight that are there where we recognize the success. And Shaul is one of those complex personalities who had much credit to his record, which the Navi records, albeit in Tanakh style, records briefly. Comment about the Hagri'im. If you turn the page over, actually, no, we do that. Rabag, in the very first... four, Radak. Radak, Ima Hagri'im, who are the Hagri'im? Says the Radak, Hem B'nei Hagar.
Hagar,
as in Hagar, Eshet Abraham, Hagar. Ve'alaf m'kom yud, yud ha'yachas, ha'kol b'nei mizrach. So if you think about the generality of that statement, b'nei Hagar or b'nei Yishmael, general term for local, regional, indigenous population, if you turn the page over, you'll see a map of some of the regions in the land of Israel, or the regions that border Israel. This is a map of Shaul's military campaigns. So in the broader sense, Plishtim on the bottom left, southwest corner, Moab, southeast corner, Edom is actually in the bottom right, Amalek south, do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Amalek down south, Edom southeast, going up from there, Moab, just to the southeast of the Dead Sea, following the dotted line, you have Ammon, the area of the Gilad, north of the Gilad, the area of the Bashan. Everybody see where I'm pointing?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
North of the Bashan, you have the area of Geshur and the Ma'acha. We'll come back to those names a little bit later in the story of Shaul.
Which you have Geshur?
Yeah, it's unclear where Geshur. I didn't write these maps. But there are certain areas that we just...
Okay.
Guessing.
That were sort of educational guesses.
Okay.
And Tsova in the upper right-hand corner, Mesopotamia, so moving like up into the Iraq, Iran, Iraq, really, area today, Aleppo. Then you have to the left along the coast, opposite the Golan Heights. Do you have? You see where it says Sidonim? Okay, so Tzor and Sidon are the two border cities in Lebanon. They became very famous in the wars in Lebanon, Sire and Sidon. Tzor and Sidon, port cities, those are the Tzidonim. And if you look at the, in between all of that, you'll see the names of the tribes in each area. So up there you have Asher, further south down this, by Emek Yisrael, between Akko and Yam Kinneret, you'll have Zvulun, Yisachar, and Emek Yisrael. Below that, Menashe and Ephraim, Binyamin, Yehuda, going straight down the country. On the left side of the Yarden, you have the area of the Gilad, which is the tribal territory of Reuven, Gad, and half of Menashe. And on the very far right of this map, you'll see it says Ha'ashuri, Yitur, Nafish, Nadav, Hagriim. These were nomadic tribes in what today would be known as Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the desert area. Large desert area, and so the suggestion is that the people of Reuven in that time had expanded their territory back into the area east of the Gilad, which would put it into the territory of either Jordan and Saudi Arabia. The inserted map is gives you a bigger picture of Sova all the way up to Nahar Prat. So if you get the north part of the country, Karkamish, you sort of get a sense of where that area is. Now, what does that mean for us? That means for us is the following. This has been the picture of the map of Israel for the last 400 years that we have been learning. Feels like 400 years. No, that isn't really. Since we started Yehoshua. This was the map of Israel when Yehoshua conquers Israel. This is actually a map of the conquests of Yehoshua. Okay, so this arrow is essentially the Israelite penetration. From Kadesh, initially the story of the spies, then we come around, enter from Yericho, come south into, first we went north to the area of Shechem, Ai and Shechem, north into the area of the Giva, of north of Shechem, the northern kings, then the southern kings, down to Lachish, and then we solidified the kingdom. Yeshua moves the Mishkan from Gilgal to Shiloh, tells the tribes of Israel, go and conquer, go and live in the territory that you have conquered, and the tribes spread out, spending most of their time focusing on the mountain region, for reasons we spent a great deal of time talking about both in Yehoshua and in Shoftim. Israel tended to live in the mountain regions at that time because militarily it was a much easier territory to hold on to than the coastal regions where A, you have to deal with chariots and horses, etc., and B, you always had the advantage of the high ground in from a military perspective. So it's an interesting map because it's a mirror image of the map of Israel today, where the primary population centers are along the coast or in the valley, and the weaker population centers are in the mountains. In the time of Tanakh, it was exact opposite. The orange is Israelite. The yellow is Canaanite, or strongholds that remained unconquered. And that was the case throughout this period of history, from Yehoshua through Shoftim, and all of the various Shoftim. The Shoftim are listed on this map, Tola ben Pua, Gidon, Shemgar ben Anat, Shimshon, Yiftach. All of these Shoftim managed to successfully navigate military campaigns in their regions, but they never changed the overall picture of the map of Israel. More or less territory, but essentially the map of Israel remained this picture throughout Sefer Yehoshua, throughout Sefer Shoftim, 350 years, and the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. By the time Shmuel reverse that. By the time Shaul finishes his military campaign that is described in these four psukim, this map, we can say bye-bye to. This map will never come back to us. Welcome to the new map of Israel.
Whoa. And what year are we in welcoming the new map?
Whatever year Shaul is king. Actual years is hard to calculate because there's a whole discrepancy in discussion.
What's it about? I don't need
to know. We know it was more than 2 years.
Oh, yeah. No, his whole period of king is probably closer to 30 or 40 years. We don't know because it doesn't tell us.
Okay, 30, 40 years. So where are we in history?
Where are we in history? Work it forward from Yehoshua. Mitzrayim, we're assuming for the moment, is 2448, I think. Right, see, Mitzrayim is 2448. I can do it in Hebrew years. That's going to translate this into English years.
Okay.
In Hebrew years, the easiest way to remember it is that Avram Avinu is born in the year 1948. Okay. After that, everything becomes easy to calculate. Okay. 100 years later is the birth of Yitzchak, so that's 2048. 400 years later is Mitziah Mitzrayim, it's 2448. Right, is Mitziah Mitzrayim. 480 years after Yitziat Mitzrayim, 2448, 480 years after Yitziat Mitzrayim, is the building of the Beit HaMikdash. Because that's a pasuk in Shmuel, in Malachi, 480 years after they leave Egypt, they lay the foundation stones for the building of the first temple, Shlomo Melech's temple. So 480, 2448 plus 480.
2928.
Do that again?
2928.
480, 448
and 480 is
988. Okay. 928. Right. That puts us into Shlomo. So now, into year 4 of Shlomo. Work your way backwards. 4 of Shlomo is 20. Take away 4 of Shlomo is 2924. 40 of David is 2884. So David HaMelech comes to the throne in the year 2884. Shaul is the years before that.
So 2854. He reigned for 30 years.
More or less. Okay, so let's say approximately 2850. The way to calculate the English year is to subtract a 3. Why do I think it's 3790?
No idea.
Or 3760? I don't remember. I don't remember how to calculate the transfer, but that's the more or less.
So
if we're in 5776, do the math.
3006.
We just celebrated. There's a famous couple of number of years ago. We celebrated the 3,000 year anniversary of Yerushalayim.
926.
Okay, so, and that's David post Shaul. So more or less, 3,000 years. Backwards, 1000 BC. Okay.
So in that era, that's when we never go back to the older map that's on the ground.
Correct.
We're finished.
That's it. We're done. Our study of Tanakh is now here. Now look at this map carefully.
Well,
we went from.
Not room here.
And by the way, I have a present for you.
We get a new map.
You get a new map.
Oh, boy.
You get a new map in color, and I'll ask you to send the extras back here. Take a look at this map carefully. Okay? Take a look at this map carefully. A number of things stand out in this map. So first of all, I'm not necessarily sure I agree with the way this map was made. This map comes from a book called the Bible Atlas. It's actually a non-Jewish source. Right?
What?
The actual Bible Atlas maps, index and chronological tables, made by Karta, Yerushalayim, but it's And it's academically correct. It's just, you know, land of Canaan, the coming of the Israelites, the kingdom of David and Solomon, the kingdom of Judah and Israel, the world of the Greeks, the Roman Empire, Palestine in Greek or Roman times, Jesus in his land, Jesus in Galilee, journeys of the apostles.
That does sound
you,
Jewish.
You understand from that. Okay, so but what's interesting about this map is a couple of things. So first of all, if you look at the dotted line, this dotted line is supposedly, and I add that word intentionally, where it says here, the boundary of Saul's kingdom. This is a map of the kingdom of David and Solomon, meaning this is supposed to be, the orange is supposed to be the United Kingdom of Israel. The green is ostensibly the territory conquered by David.
Wow.
So when you look at it together, orange and green is essentially the territory of Malchut David.
Boy, he was a warrior.
Wow. And we know that he was a warrior.
He was busy.
But, but I draw your attention to what we just read. Against whom was Shaul successful in his campaigns? Edom, Moab, Ammon, and Malchitzova. So whether or not they considered those territories now annexed or part of Malchut Shaul is unclear. David and Melech clearly conquered and included that territory under his control. It's unclear whether he was just staving off enemies or actually expanding the territory of his kingdom. But from a military point of view, the region in which Shaul is operating is no smaller than the region in which David's military campaigns operated, and with a much smaller, younger army.
What are we still in our bag of that anyway?
So it's important.
So that's why we gave it back.
Right.
So it's important to recognize. Now there are certain territories that we never were able to address properly. One of them is Eretz Plishtim, which remains Eretz Plishtim. The other is the Phoenicians in the north, which is all a different story. And Amalek's not listed here, but we'll talk about Amalek in our next piece. Okay, so this is, the orange is the dual monarchy, the green is the territory conquered by David, and the orange, then the dotted line is ostensibly the territory of Malchut Shaul, but given the regions in which his military operated, I would include this whole sweep, all the way up to, if you're including Sova, all the way up to the Euphrates, as region in which Shaul's region of influence, if you will, is successful, and he certainly establishes the foundation of the kingdom of Israel. So as an aside, as a kind of a concluding remark, these psukim give us a very different picture of Malchut Shaul overall than just by reading the story of the Battle of Michmas, or the Battle of Amalek, or the Battle of Yavesh Gilead. So they're kind of tucked in the back of chapter 14.
So where's those Phoenicians? Is that Lebanon today? Or part of Lebanon?
North
today?
Of Lebanon today.
It's
see,
north of
here's
Lebanon.
Tyre.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tyre is part of Lebanon. The actual political boundaries of the Middle East today are somewhat arbitrary.
Yeah.
And they're historically arbitrary. They're created artificially.
World War One or World War Two?
World War One. In the aftermath of World War One, the whole Middle East was carved up into nations that don't necessarily match. part of this, the cinder box of the Middle East is that the nation border divisions, or the state border divisions, had no reflection in the ethnic divisions within the region, and that just created an artificial and a lot of tension around those borders. But if you look at the Israelite area, which is the orange, goes all the way up to just south of Tyre. And Dan is here in the Golan Heights, Mount Hermon. This is the Litani River. This area here, Sidon, Byblos, etc., that is all the way up to, I don't see it on this map as much as on that one. That is what is part of today's Lebanon. In Tanakh, it was the land of the Phoenicians. And they were always, well, certainly the days of David and Shlomo, they were allies. Hiram Melech Tzor, who was Shlomo's partner in the building of the Beit HaMikdash, provided all the cedars from Lebanon for the trees and the wood of the Beit HaMikdash, etc. So there's a lot of trade between the Phoenician ships and the port cities and Israel. This is from a geopolitical, economic point of view, an important alliance that we create. Unlike the Plishtim, with whom there was never an alliance. Well, that's also not true. David had an alliance with the Plishtim, but that's a come to that.
So that was only temporary, right?
Right. Come to that. We will get to that. So is this clear? This is sort of a concluding remark. It almost sounds like the story of Shaul is done. Right? We're finished now with Shaul, and now we're going to move on to the next story. And the text is written that way. It's not quite that simple, because we still have the major story of Shaul, which is, of course, Amalek. And Amalek is post to these psukim. But that's because the story is written as the story of Shaul is done, concluding remarks about Shaul, and then essentially the story of Amalek, which is Shaul's final failure, for which the kingdom is taken away from him, is recorded post these psukim. Why? Because it's not really part of the story of Shaul's kingdom, it's the story of why the kingdom was taken away from him and given to David. So really, in a sense, it forms the introduction to David. And therefore, even though chronologically it may have happened before these psukim, possibly, or at least before some of the events here, it is recorded after. That's one piece. A second piece is our observation is the family of David. Sorry, the family of Shaul. You know, there's a lot of detail here about the family of Shaul, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through the who is who. Obviously, there's familial connections. There's Avner ben Ner, Dod Shaul. So Avner is his general. He's Shaul's cousin. Avner will remain a personality in the story until the end of the Sefer, because throughout the years of the civil war between David and Shaul, the two generals involved in that struggle are Avner ben Ner on the side of Shaul and Yoav ben Suya on the side of David. So the war between David and Shaul is fought out in Beshetach, on the battlefield between Yoav and Avner. So we are now for the first time introduced to Avner as his general. In all the previous stories of Shaul, who's the general leading the army?
Yonatan.
Well, Yonatan is the second, if you will. He's the prince. Right? Who's the general leading the army? In all the previous stories?
Shaul.
Because that's part of the role of the king. As you solidify the kingdom and expand the kingdom and grow the kingdom, suddenly you have a large army. No longer is the king found on the battlefield as the general leading the army. Now suddenly there's a general in charge of the army, Sar Tzava, and the king is the king, which I expect in a military in a malchut context. We've shifted from the world of the shofet, where the shofet is leading the army, to the world of the melech, where the melech has under him a Sar Tzava, a general working with him. There's a couple of names here that we will see. We'll come back to as the story unfolds. First of all, we have the names of Shaul's sons, including the names of Shaul's and the names of Shaul's daughters, Michal and Merav.
Wife.
Typically, and his wife. The wife is almost always recorded because usually you need to know kings had many wives, political alliances, etc. But only from one wife was ever chosen the heir to the throne, and hence there was always an identity listed of the heir to the throne and who his mother was. Throughout Sefer Melachim, you'll find that. Right? The king, after the king dies, the son who took the throne was Yaram or Yoshafat, whatever it was. Hashem Imo, and his mother's name was. Why is his mother's name important? Because of the entire harem or list of all of the wives of the king, there's only one that's ever chosen as the primary wife. And from her, her firstborn is the heir to the throne. So the heir to the throne isn't necessarily the oldest son of the king.
So who decides who's the main wife? The king?
The king.
Not Hashem or anything.
No. King. And hence, we will come, that piece of it we'll come back to when we look at David, because that's a lot of the dynamic of the story of the house of David and the rebellions of Avshalom and Adoniyahu are built around who's the legitimate heir to the throne, which son of which wife is the legitimate heir to the throne, including the conflict over Shlomo, who's the son of Bathsheba. And the question of her status will become a major subject of discussion. So that's part of Shmuel Bet. Sort of map out our discussion. But the name of the wife, Michal and Merav. Michal and Merav are also connected to the story of David, because
Michal was married to him now.
Michal was married to him.
But then
and so is Merav, actually, at some point or another. But
I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
Man, some
fathers have nothing on it. But Michal is married to him, which means that David is the son-in-law of the king. And when Yonatan steps aside and doesn't seem to want to take the heir to the throne, right? The most logical choice could be easily his son-in-law. And so the relationship between David and Shaul through Michal is critical, because she is the link to the Malchus. So the names of the daughters are important. In addition, there are sons of Shaul who are not listed here. So even though it lists the three sons of Shaul, namely Yonatan, Yishvi, and Malkishua, we know that there are other sons of Shaul. For example, okay, we know off the bat at least one that's not who's missing.
Absalom was David's son.
Absalom was David's son, correct.
Everybody knows who the wife, who the, you know, first lady of the house is.
Did Abigail have, no, Abigail
Achinoam? Shaul's wife, Achinoam? Or you mean, is it public knowledge who the primary wife is? Usually.
Right, everybody knows.
Usually.
Who's the?
Usually.
The main wife.
The
first
lady. It could be fraught with conflict, right? In David's case, he chose Bathsheba, and that was an unpopular choice. So that was that leads to much of the rebellion in the days of David. But it's usually public known. So there are clearly there are sons missing here. For example, Ishbosheth. Who's Ishbosheth?
That's a name from the Bible.
Right? Who's Ishbosheth?
Must be important.
It is important. Many years later, supposedly, when Shaul dies in battle, take a look actually on the source page. I've given it to you, source 6. Right.
Mm-hmm.
After the death of Shaul, Shaul dies in the end of Shmuel Aleph. Now, in the Battle of HaGibor, and then David becomes the king. But Avner Ben-Ner, who is Avner Ben-Ner?
His general.
General of?
And his cousin.
General of?
Shaul.
Sar Tzva Asher LeShaul. Okay, in case we forget. Lakach et Ishboshet Ben Shaul Vayavireu Machanaim Vayemlicheu Al Gilad Vel Ashuri Vel Yisrael Vel Ephraim Vel Binyamin Vel Yisrael Kulo. Immediately after Shaul's death, when David became king, was trying to become king, after a lengthy, protracted civil war, Avner took Ishbosheth ben Shaul. Who is Ishbosheth ben Shaul? Ishbosheth, son of Shaul, who he felt was the legitimate heir to the throne. Correct? He thought was the legitimate heir to the throne. And he took him over to Machanaim. Anybody remember where Machanaim is? Machanaim is a famous story in Tanakh. It's in the area of the Gilad. Now, do you remember why it's famous? What happened at Machanaim?
Something there?
Excuse me?
Did he move something there? No?
there was an attempt to create an alternative kingdom of Israel there. That's Israel. Here. But Machanayim is the location where Yaakov, on his return back from Laban's house, meets the Malachim. Gaba Malachel Akim, he meets the angels and he sees that there's a camp of angels with him. It's on the banks of the Yabok River. Be that as it may, Avner crosses over. Right, so it's on the map. Avner crosses over into the east side of the Yarden, and there he coronates Ishbosheth to create a rebellion against David. That there should be an heir to the throne of Shaul. Ishbosheth. Okay, what's the problem?
Was everybody else dead then?
Well, Shaul dies Yonatan on Har Gilboa with, who did he die with in Har Gilboa?
Yonatan.
His three sons. He had three sons with him in Har Gilboa. Almost. Take a look at Source 5. Source 5 is the fall of Shaul in Har Gilboa. Shmuel Aleph, Perek Lamed Aleph. Vayidbeku plishtimet Shaul vet banav vayaku plishtimet Yonatan vet Avinadav vet Malkishua b'nei Shaul. The Plishtim killed Shaul and his three sons, Yonatan, Avinadav, and Malkishua.
They left out that other one.
So here's the problem, is that the three sons of Shaul, as listed here, are Yonatan, Yishvi, and Malkishua. The three sons listed in the fall of Har Gilboa are Yonatan, Avinadav, and Malkishua, and in neither case is Ishbosheth mentioned. Ishbosheth is mentioned in Divrei HaYamim, of course, no surprise there. If you take a look at source, well, it's actually the chart at the bottom of the page, Pasuk Lamed Tet, on the right side, V'ner olidet Kish, V'kish olidet Shaul, V'Shaul olidet Yonatan, V'et Malkishua, V'et Avinadav, V'et Eshba'al. Who is Eshba'al? Where did he come from?
Who is
so, just to give you a quick picture of the house of Shaul, or the children of Shaul, I have
Yonatan.
That's easy.
Malkishua.
I have Yishvi and Malkishua.
Avinadav.
Then I have Avinadav, who falls in Har, and Yonatan, Malkishua, and Avinadav all fall in Har Gilboa. So the Radak and the Rabak and other Mefarshim suggest that Yishvi and Avinadav are the same person.
He took a Hebrew name.
Maybe it's a middle name. I don't know.
It's possible. Or it's possible it's a nickname. We don't know. But it's but that's the most logical suggestion. Then I have
Ishbosheth.
And Eshbal.
Eshbal.
That's a Syrian name. Ishbal.
So comes along the, who is it? When I see it, where's Radak? Yeah, the Radak in source 7. And makes the following suggestion. That Yishvi and Avinadav is the same person.
Mm-hmm.
That's easy. And these are the three sons mentioned here, and not Ishbosheth or Ishbal, because these are the ones who go out to war with him and who fall
in
Har Gilboa. Therefore, they're mentioned here. So other sons that he has, as we'll see, there's another pasuk that talks about two sons of two Pelegeshes. Right? There are other sons. They're not relevant because these are the ones who fall in battle. They're the ones who went out to battle with him. They're the ones who fall in battle. And after the death of Shaul, Yonatan, Yishvi, Avinadav, and Malkishua, there's only one son left, who's never mentioned before, except in Divrei HaYamim. And that one son is Ishbosheth, who's referred to in Divrei HaYamim as Ishbal.
Oh, so they're the same.
Oh.
So these are also the same.
Oh, wow.
So how does Ishbosheth become Ishbal?
Yeah.
Or how does Ishbal become Ishbosheth? And here the Redak says something remarkable.
Typo?
But I think it's very true. No, it's not a typo, but I think it's very true.
You use some of the same letters.
You have to remember names in Tanakh are significant. And names in Tanakh often reflect a kind of theological or ideological identity. It's not an accident that the names of so many kings of Israel or Nevi'im in Israel have letters of Shem Hashem embedded in their names. Uziyahu, Yehoshaphat, Chaziyahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel. Identity, especially amongst leaders, identity with Shem Hashem was a theological connection. When Achav marries his famous
Jezebel.
Wife,
Jezebel,
okay, whose father is the king of Sidon, right? So his wife's name is Izebel Bat Et Baal. Now look at a couple of things. Et Baal in Aramaic is equal to Ish Baal.
Bad news.
Yeah.
Because that was the same as Yoachaz or Yoshiyahu, or right? It's a theological identity. These were Baal, loyal to Baal, Canaanite regional indigenous population kings. So, no surprise. Izebel et Baal is the father. Izebel is Eshet Baal.
Wow.
Because that's how you named sons and daughters. That's how your theological identity. Ish Baal et Baal. Eshet Baal is Baal or Izebel, and hence the English transliteration of Izebel is Jezebel, not a name I would recommend not a name that I would recommend.
I've never met a Jezebel yet.
I have, actually.
Really?
Where were you?
Okay. Now, from that perspective, come back to Eshbaal. Now, Eshbaal isn't necessary, right? Eshbaal, says the Radak, is Ish Baal.
Wow.
Right? Which is not necessarily a nice name for a Jewish boy.
No, the son of Saul.
Right? Mm-hmm. Ish Baal. Ish Baal, remember that Baal is a Avodah Zarah.
Right.
So the Navi, in its style, will refer to Ish Baal as Ish Boshet. Boshet is?
Smell.
Excuse me?
Smell?
No, boshet, the word boshet means shame.
Busha.
Busha.
Right? Exactly. It's the same root. So this is a pejorative of the Navi. To call Ish Baal, Ish Boshet.
Yeah.
That's a pejorative of the Navi. But in fact, it's the same person, and that's the one, the last remaining son, who probably wasn't in line for the throne initially. We don't necessarily know who his mother was. Remember that the kings married many wives. It could be that Shaul's wife, mother of Ishbosheth, is a different mother than the other three, and that's also an explanation as to why these three are mentioned, but not Ishbaal. They had one mother, they had another. Okay. And this mother may have had Canaanite loyalties, named her son Ishbaal. Shaul had no intention of making him heir to the throne. Had three other sons heir to the throne, all three of whom died on the battlefield. And when the story is over and David is asserting himself as king, Avner takes the last remaining son of Shaul, and although his mother was a Canaanite and his identity was one of Ish Baal or Ish Boshet, tries to make him king of Israel. Doesn't last very long. And the end result is that he too dies in the battle, in the civil war with David, and that ends the rebellion. So, that's the story of names. And I threw this in as a kind of an assertion, because it's really remarkable how much you can learn from what seems to be almost extraneous and somewhat irrelevant information. We spent an hour and 10 minutes learning about Shaul and about his kingdom and about his wars and about his family and about the dynamic of Jewish history from five psukim that discuss the wars of Shaul and the family of Shaul. Interesting observation. Which brings us to Perek Tetvav. Bezrat Hashem, next week we start the story of Amalek.
And you'll bring these maps next week?
These maps, if you... I can have them with me, but if you would...
Okay, I'll try to keep...
Hold on to them. You can hold on to them. They're yours.
So the color ones we should keep.